Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Head of the Serpent by Alan Manning and Brian Manning. Narrated by Roger Wayne. Chapter 1. 8 months had passed since the United States government decommissioned the Hostile Response Division. Under the supervision of the U.S. military and critical personnel in the Department of Homeland Security, the HRD was a joint task force, responsible for combating domestic threats with international ramifications. Price Wyndham was one such man, attempting to acquire a prototype weapon capable of defeating the most sophisticated encryption to engage in cyber warfare. Price was on the verge of shifting the balance of power in the global theater of war, selling his talents to the highest bidder. Recruited by the HRD at that time, John Stone lent his talents to the team to track down and stop Wyndham. For John, it went beyond the mission. He had a personal stake in the matter, tracking down the men responsible for murdering his friend, Frank Colt, and kidnapping his goddaughter, Emily. During that time, John found himself accused of committing acts of domestic terrorism. The Secretary of Defense relieved Marvin Van Pierce, the director of the Hostile Response Division, of command. The Hostile Response Division took on a new mission: find and capture John Stone. On the run and hunted by two opposing forces, John eventually stopped Price Wyndham, revealing evidence that linked him to specific government officials in direct command of the HRD. With the help of his friends still in the HRD, it was more than enough to clear John of all charges. DHS spearheaded an investigation to uncover the depths of corruption within the government. The aim was to identify and remove the people responsible for infiltrating the Hostile Response Division and any other branches and organizations compromised by the treasonous acts. John felt the investigation would be fruitless, with corrupt influence still holding sway over crucial positions of power conducting the investigation. It would be years before the cancer could be rooted out, and he no longer had the desire to work for the Hostile Response Division, or any organization similar. John stepped away and returned home to his previous life of peace. Great Falls, Montana. The sun rose through the clear blue sky, radiating its early afternoon heat. A late spring breeze blew defiantly against the arrival of the coming summer. John Stone wiped an arm across his forehead as he stood to admire the repairs he'd made to his porch railing. He found himself away from his home for much of the past year, but now that he was free, he spent his days fixing the place up. The hammer clanged into his toolbox as John dropped it before flipping the lid closed with his boot. He hoisted the tools up as he looked off in the distance. The sound of a car approaching reached him before he could actually see it. A dark sedan drove past the surrounding trees into the clearing and pulled up the long dirt road to his estate. It was no surprise to John, as he lived in a somewhat secluded area, and any car around here would be heading to his house. The car slowed to a stop on the driveway, tires crunching along the gravel, and the driver's side door swung open. A fit man with a light brown complexion stepped out. He kept his hair cut short, but was currently sporting the stubble of a beard that was only now starting to show a little gray. His easygoing expression was a contradiction to the authority he could exude with little effort. The man smiled, revealing a set of straight white teeth set into a square jaw.
"It's been a while, huh, John?" he said.
"Not long enough to have to see your ugly mug again," John said.
Marvin Van Pierce gave him a look of mock offense.
"Son, if you were half as good-looking as me, you would shave that mustache off so everyone could see your face."
After a moment of intense stares, both men erupted into laughter.
"Come on in. I've got some beers in the fridge," John said,
as he gestured to invite the man into his home. The interior of John's mountain cabin was sparsely decorated, yet comfortable. Though not minimalist, everything inside had its purpose and was sturdy in design. Its utilitarian nature reminded Van Pierce of the precision of a military barracks, but done with warm wood colors and plenty of natural light from the cabin's windows. John led Van Pierce to a small, round oak kitchen table. Marvin took a seat, and John pulled two bottles of beer from the fridge. He twisted the tops off and slid one across the table as he sat down. Marvin took a long swallow of the ice-cold drink and let out a sigh. The two men sat at the table like they were about to share stories of the good old days. But both of them knew that's not why the former HRD director would have driven all this way to visit.
"Any progress on the investigation?"
John asked. "You don't waste time, do you, John?" "Always a straight shooter," Van Pierce said. John took a sip of his beer but said nothing. "As a matter of fact, the investigation is still ongoing. The reports say they found one or two people involved in the lower-level government positions. They have yet to find any evidence implicating any officials at a higher level."
"Why am I not surprised?" John asked.
"Hey, there's nothing we can do about that right now. Let's be thankful that you were found not guilty of any wrongdoing, and just move on."
Marvin took another sip from his bottle.
"Besides, that's actually not why I'm here."
John raised an eyebrow, curious.
"I'm consulting," Van Pierce said. "I help other people catch bad guys now. Got a job working with a counter-terror task force in France."
John nodded, twirling a bottle cap between his fingers.
"Sounds lucrative."
"It pays the bills. If you want to come with me, I can make a call."
"No, I'm done,"
John interrupted. Marvin's expression didn't change. He knew John would refuse.
"Figured you wouldn't be interested. But I needed to toss the offer out there anyway. If you ever change your mind, you just say the word, and you're in," Van Pierce said.
John didn't speak, instead lifting his bottle and tilting his head in a thanks-for-the-offer gesture. He was really settling into this quiet, peaceful part of his life right now. They finished the rest of their beers, admiring the serene view out the window, and sharing some casual talk to catch up. John stood up as Marvin prepared to leave.
"It's been nice seeing you again, old man," John said with a grin.
Marvin laughed and clapped him on the shoulder. They shared a firm handshake between two tough old soldiers.
"Goodbye, John."
"Goodbye, Marvin."
John watched the man head out the door. He was not as tall as Stone, but Van Pierce projected an authority that many were not capable of. John stood on the porch giving one last wave as the dark sedan pulled away and back down the dirt road. He contemplated the offer, tempted to feel that rush again, but the feeling left as fast as it came. The quiet life was all he wanted now. John finally turned and walked back into his house.
Chapter 2 Lyon, France.
3 days after his meeting with John Stone, Marvin Van Pierce was in France, coordinating with the elite tactical unit of the French National Police. Known as RAID, the Recherche, Assistance, Intervention, Dissuasion Unit, was responsible for counterterrorism operations within the major cities of the country. With the recent deactivation of the Hostile Response Division and the reassignment of its active military members, Van Pierce became a highly recommended consultant by close contacts that he maintained with the United States government. His knowledge and experience battling terrorist groups and investigating acts of terrorism over the past 40 years made him an invaluable asset. On his current assignment, Van Pierce lent his knowledge and experience to the French government, coordinating with them to help locate and stop a new terrorist group that had splintered from ISIS. Though the group went active less than 1 year ago, they've already claimed responsibility for 3 public terrorist attacks throughout Europe, the last one occurring only a week ago. Now, Van Pierce sat in a small meeting room with Maurice Overoud, the General Secretary for Administration in the Ministry of the Armed Forces, Lionel Gavreau, the RAID Task Force leader, and a second-in-command, Christopher Brassard. A computer analyst and a language translator also sat in the room, to help out when needed. Various photos plastered one wall of the room. Shots of French landmarks and government buildings covered part of it, while persons of interest filled another section. Passport pictures or other official ID photos and surveillance shots of unsuspecting suspects were tacked up and overlapping every available space. Whiteboards, covered in handwritten notes about the terrorist group and its members, sat on an adjacent wall. The sloppiness of the writing on the boards and his being rusty reading French made the information all but useless to Van Pierce. The RAID task force leader stood at the front of the room and briefed everyone. He spoke mostly French, while the translator relayed the information to the American consultant, Though his reading was rusty, Marvin still had an ear for the language and was able to follow most of it without the help.
"The mission of this new group, known as the Four Serpents, is, for all purposes, the same as ISIS. But we believe they are attempting to escalate the levels of conflict," Gavro said.
"What does that mean?" Avrard asked.
"Tracking all known and suspected members, we are finding evidence through captured emails and phone conversations that show an interest in increasing the size of their targets and the number of casualties."
"How many members have you found so far?" Van Pierce asked, also speaking in French.
"As far as confirmed members, our analysts have discovered these three," Gavro said,
pointing to three photos lined up at the top of the photo wall.
"This is Basim El-Nazar. He was a known lower-ranking member of ISIS. His move to join the Serpents may have come with a promotion."
The photo was a surveillance shot, slightly blurry from being enlarged and zoomed.
"Abdul Ghani Al-Bashir is an engineer with a master's degree in chemistry. We strongly suspect he has built explosive devices used in past terrorist attacks, also for ISIS," Gavro continued.
The translator continued to speak to Van Pierce as if he didn't understand French, but the American focused on the three photos while listening directly to the raid commander.
"Finally, this is Azhar bin Hashim. He has declared himself the leader of the Four Serpents and has made no attempt to hide his intentions. The problem, however, is that we have almost no information about bin Hashim's past. He has no known connection to any past terrorist activity or group."
Van Pierce narrowed his eyes at this information, and he studied the passport photo.
"Are you sure he's the leader and not just a puppet?" the American asked.
"Unlikely he's a puppet," the computer analyst blurted. "So far, we haven't traced any outgoing signals of any type from bin Hashim that go to anyone other than the lower-ranking suspected members."
Van Pierce eyed the young analyst.
"Son, there are still effective ways to communicate that are older than cell phones and email."
"Again, unlikely. The amounts of coordination to pull off the attacks the Serpents have done in the past, and the ones they are possibly planning in the future, require exact precision and constant communication. We're confident that Azhar bin Hashim is the head of the Serpent."
Van Pierce stared at the arrogant computer analyst until the man glanced down into the reports on the desk in front of him. Then Gavro continued.
"Our analysts suspect Basim El-Nazar will meet with someone believed to have financed past terrorist attacks in Europe. We have no identification on this person except for his alias, Matthias Kepler, which we have learned with the aid of Mr. Van Pierce's U.S. contacts."
Everyone in the room was now studying the notes in front of them to learn what little they could about the mystery financier.
"There is a high probability that the meeting will be occurring in the Place des Terreurs in Lyon tomorrow. If we can spot El-Nazar and follow him to the meeting, we may be able to identify the financier," Gavro said.
"It's a very public location. Many tourists," Overard said. "I can't stress the importance of not letting the situation get out of hand."
"Rest assured, sir, we plan to handle the entire operation covertly. Our operatives will be undercover and will not escalate the conflict unless absolutely necessary," Gavro said.
Avrard still looked a bit nervous, but nodded his approval.
"I guess that's a universal attitude for all government suits," Van Pierce thought.
The last few minutes of the meeting were spent giving a general plan the raid team would take before Gavro dismissed everyone.
"It all goes down tomorrow, gentlemen. Let's all get some rest," Gavro said.
Marvin Van Pierce rubbed his index finger along the bezel of his watch as he checked the time. 0900 hours. He sat in the passenger seat of a two-door silver Peugeot parked on the street, one block southwest from Place des Terreaux, between the Saône and Rhône rivers in Lyon. The crowds grew thicker as more people arrived in the square. Van Pierce was there that day as an extra set of eyes, and as a consultant to assist if the situation went sideways. It was made very clear to him by both Maurice Ovrard and Lionel Gavro that he was not to have any physical involvement with today's operation. Being a foreigner and not an official member of any French police or military organization, they weren't interested in the possibility of an international incident. In the driver's seat, Simone Boudet, a RAID team member, was radioing updates. Van Pierce didn't have his own radio, so he listened to the responses coming in over Boudet's. Nearly a dozen RAID members positioned themselves in and around the Place de Terreau. They dressed in civilian clothing and blended in almost entirely. A few blocks away, in a nondescript panel truck, a RAID unit sat in full operational gear, prepared to move in if the situation spun out of control. 2 hours into the operation, radio chatter picked up. A couple of the undercover RAID members spotted Basim El-Nazar entering the southeast side of the square. Gavreau's voice came in over the channel, advising all teams to keep their eyes open. Radio communication from three different undercover operatives following covertly described the path El-Nazar took through the square. Responses from the other RAID members followed, giving their current position and status. This continued for the next few minutes as Marvin glanced up the street toward the Place de Terreau, even though he wasn't near the radioed positions. He scanned everyone, looking for postures or behaviors that might appear suspicious. It was a habit he gained from many years in the field, and was now second nature for him. It was because of this awareness that a face in the crowd triggered an alarm in his head. A man, with a jagged scar across his cheek, walked right past the silver Peugeot and into a crowd of tourists. Van Pierce snatched up his smartphone and scrolled through the photos from yesterday's briefing. His fingers froze on an image of a man with the same scar and intense eyes. It was Zane Alamon, someone the French government had suspected of being a member of the Four Serpents, but they couldn't verify. His appearance in this place at this time was just too much to be a coincidence. "That man there," Van Pierce said to his partner in the car, "that's Zane Alamon. We need someone on him now." Boudet nodded and radioed in the request. Van Pierce tried to keep a visual on his target as the radio responses came. "This is Unit 2. I can be there in 3 minutes." "That's not fast enough. He's going to disappear in that crowd," Van Pierce said, knowing how far they were positioned from the square. Without hesitation, he opened the door to follow Alamon. "Sir, you can't—" Boudet began before he was cut off. "Let the team know I'm tailing Alamon. Have them coordinate with me when they reach my location," Van Pierce said. Then he slipped into the crowd of people. Gavreau was positioned outside the Place de Terreau, in a discreet position that gave him a broad view of the area. He gritted his teeth at the call he just received from Boudet. Marvin Van Pierce was actively pursuing a man that may be on their list of suspected terrorist group members. Gavreau didn't want anyone but RAID personnel active in the area. Van Pierce was experienced, but the possible confusion and chaos of having a foreigner, a civilian at that, active in the operation, didn't sit well with the task force leader. Still, without the Americans' help, Gavreau's team may not have spotted the extra player. Van Pierce didn't have a radio with him, however, which made the situation even more frustrating. After a moment of thought, he thumbed his own radio.
"Unit 2, as soon as you get there, you relieve Mr. Van Pierce and have him stand down."
"Oui,"
the response came over the radio quickly. Gavreau set his focus back on observing the square while listening to the updates from the team following El-Nazar.
"Heading toward the cafe, on the east side of the fountain. This might be the meeting spot," one of the RAID members said.
"All right, stay on him, and let us know if he leaves. All units, I want you to scan everyone in the area. Find anyone that might be there to meet him," Gavreau said.
After a minute of updates being radioed in, one transmission caught the task leader's attention.
"El-Nazar made contact with someone. They split up. The new target is moving southeast."
Gavreau prepared to coordinate his team to account for the new player when the radio channels lit up.
"He's got a bomb! El-Nazar!"
The radio transmission cut off a split second before Gavreau heard the explosions. Marvin Van Pierce worked his way through the crowd, tailing his target from a reasonable distance. He was a little rusty from years of not being out in the field, but found his skills were recalled pretty easily. Alamon crossed the street and entered the Place de Terreau from the southwest corner. He stayed on the outer edge, slowing and eventually stopping. He glanced around casually across the public square. A tremendous sculptured fountain, the Fontaine Bartholdi, dominated the center of the Place de Terreau. It featured a woman on a chariot, controlling four horses, each representing the four great rivers of France. Crowds gathered around the sculpture, sitting at the outdoor tables set up under canopies for the nearby restaurants. Lamont turned his gaze toward Marvin, but Van Pierce was sure to not make eye contact with his target, instead pretending to study the large fountain in the square. Next, Van Pierce swept his gaze across the area, looking for the other raid members. There were too many people around for him to make a positive ID on any of them, however. When he looked back, he saw Elamon reaching into the inner pocket of his jacket. Van Pierce moved closer, his focus like a laser on his target. Panicked voices suddenly screamed out from across the square. In the next instant, they were cut off by a deafening explosion. Van Pierce tore his eyes off Elamon and toward the blast. He felt the concussive force press against his chest, even this far away from the explosion, and saw smoke and dust rising in the northeast corner of the square, just past the fountain. Confusion and fear took the crowd. Then it turned to outright chaos and panic when the second blast went off. He saw the second explosion this time. It was a suicide bomber, also on the far side of the square in the southeast corner. While he turned his attention back to Elamon, Van Pierce whipped his hand to the back of his right hip, a pure reflex, and found the spot where he carried his pistol for so many years empty. He saw his target holding a small device now, staring into the crowd of people. The two explosions caused a panic as terror washed over everyone, like the fire and heat from the blasts themselves. They ran away from the death and destruction and out of the square. Sudden horror dawned on Van Pierce. The two explosions had occurred on the other end of the public square, detonated in a position that would force the panicked bystanders to move in this direction. Lambs led to the slaughter, right into the position of Alamon, the third bomber. Van Pierce cursed himself for being too late to catch the attacks, but he sprang into action, knowing he had to do something right now. He bolted for Alamon, shoving people away and shouting a warning to the bystanders. He shot in low and buried his shoulder into Alamon's midsection. The momentum of his body carried the man off his feet. Van Pierce wouldn't be able to stop this blast, but he would try to minimize the damage it could cause. He plowed the man into the street, between a panel truck and a van that stopped after the first explosion. The two men landed partially under the delivery truck when the explosives engulfed Elamon and Van Pierce in fire and fury.
Chapter 3.
At approximately 11 a.m. local time, 9 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, three men detonated explosive devices strapped to their bodies in the Place de Tourneau located in Lyon, France. John stared at his television in silence, watching the news report about the terrorist attack in France. The damage in the public square is extensive. 10 people have been confirmed dead at this time, and at least 50 people have been injured by the blasts. Once again, the Four Serpents have claimed responsibility for this horrific terrorist attack. In a video statement released, a sense of dread formed in the pit of his stomach. John stood and walked to the phone, each step only serving to intensify his fears. He had to call to make sure Marvin Van Pierce was okay. The phone rang right as he grabbed hold of it. John closed his eyes and brought the receiver up to his ear.
Hello? John, it's Parker.
Hearing Parker Lewis's voice confirmed his worst fears. Before joining the Hostile Response Division, John had saved Parker's life. He was a brilliant, if eccentric, computer specialist for the HRD.
Parker, I need to call Van Pierce. He may be hurt, John said. John, I'm sorry. Van Pierce is dead, Parker said.
John's fist tightened over the phone receiver, nearly crushing it in his grip. Deep down, he knew it was the truth. Parker wouldn't be calling John to get more information. If he was calling, that meant he already knew the situation.
Are you sure?
John asked, holding out hope that his gut was wrong.
Yes. Marvin told me about his assignment after he spoke with you. The moment I heard the news about the attack, I scoured around for everything I could about it. Officers on the scene confirmed his identity 10 minutes ago. It hasn't gone public yet.
Numbness set in as John's vision swam. He clutched the phone tighter and sat at the chair next to the small table.
Are you all right, John?
Parker asked. John sat in silence for what felt like hours before finally answering.
I should have gone with him. If I was there, maybe... There's nothing you could have done. It was a coordinated attack that no one was prepared for. If you were there with Marvin, you might be dead too.
John knew Parker was right, but had a hard time accepting it. Parker's words hit John deeply, but at that moment he had made a decision.
"I'm going to France. I need to know what happened,"
John said, resigned.
"John, what do you think you can accomplish there? We aren't with the HRD anymore. Just stay there and I'll find out what I can," Parker said. "Please."
John's neck and jaw tightened.
"I'm leaving tonight."
"Then let me come with you. I can help,"
Parker started.
"No, it's dangerous. I don't want you to risk your life over this," John said.
"But it's okay if you do?"
Parker asked.
"This isn't your responsibility. I could have helped Van Pierce. But now I need answers. I owe him that much."
Parker let out a sigh on the other end.
"All right, John. Please be careful. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help. I owe him too."
Chapter 4. Shoulders brushing the walls of the narrow alleyway, a burly man strode through the back entrance of a small printing shop. The whirring and clattering of machines replaced the bustle of activity from outside. The man widened his eyes, waiting for them to adjust to the darkness before proceeding. He stepped into a back room, shuffled to one corner, and greeted three men sitting around a table. The man facing him, Azar bin Hashim, nodded as he took another drag from his cigarette.
"Praise be to Allah," the man said with his head bowed. "What do you have for me?"
bin Hashim asked as smoke puffed out between syllables. The man produced a small tablet computer. He tapped the screen a few times and handed the device over to the leader. Bin Hashim examined the information, the blue LED glow lighting his face from underneath, casting his features with a more sinister appearance. Satisfied, he nodded and placed the device casually on the center of the table.
"Is this information accurate?" he asked.
"Yes. We have confirmation that the German survived," the man said.
Bin Hashim thought over the information for a minute, taking another drag from his cigarette. He blew out a stream of smoke.
"Send someone to Hôpital de la Croix Rouge. Find the German and finish what we started," bin Hashim said. "The next phase of our plan is too important. We must tie up all loose ends."
The man nodded to the leader of the four serpents and walked out, exiting through the back door where he entered.
"What should we do now?"
one of the other men at the table asked.
"Proceed as planned. The doctor will be in town soon. Have the men ready to move when they hear from me," bin Hashim said, stabbing the butt of the cigarette into the ashtray.
The men nodded and stood. Bin Hashim could see they all knew what was expected of them, working toward the same goal. He clutched the medallion around his neck, four snakes entwined around the world, before tucking it into his shirt. The four serpents would strike fear into the hearts of the West. They would crush the spirit of the enemy. The world would not be able to deny them any longer. Chapter 5. Lyon, France. Grabbing his bag and looping the strap over his shoulder, John draped his light jacket over one arm as he stepped out of the cab. He had difficulty sleeping on the long flight, thinking about Van Pierce and the terrorist attack from the previous day. His head hurt, and his joints creaked and protested as he stretched on the sidewalk. Knowing the police would have the area restricted, John had to walk the several remaining blocks to the Place de Tourneau. While the city was far from busy, the amount of activity near the attack surprised John. He got a feel for the block and the people as he approached his destination. The pain and fear evident in their actions, the people carried out their day-to-day activities nonetheless. An act of defiance showing the terrorists that they were still strong and unafraid after the attack. John brought only a laptop and a change of clothes, on top of the few travel necessities with him, opting to travel light. Everything he needed was with him in the bag around his shoulder, except for a weapon. He knew traveling abroad meant going in unarmed, but he didn't expect a second attack in the same location so soon. Much of the initial investigation had already happened the day before, but the police still had the entire block taped off. Investigators buzzed around, gathering evidence at the blast sites and taking pictures of everything that appeared out of place. Several officers diverted traffic to different routes, creating more confusion and congestion. The honking and understandable frustration gave John enough cover to get closer
He walked the perimeter of the plot.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?